Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, coming at you once again to pull back the curtain on the psychology of criminal minds. To open 2019, we'll be examining one of the more fascinating, yet terribly sad incidents to have emerged in the world of true crime in recent memory. While this event is most often referred to as the disappearance of Susan Powell, we need to do little more than scratch the surface on this case to see there's far more evil lurking beneath. Like the best stories, which start as a tiny seed in a single location, and then grow outward, enveloping all of society, and seemingly taking on a life of their own, that's what we get here. In December 2009, Susan Powell, a 27-year-old mother of two, disappeared from her home in West Valley City, Utah, never to be seen again. The subsequent investigation into her vanishing led police right back to the young woman's own doorstep as her husband, Josh Powell, became a suspect. In the years following the disappearance, authorities have come to believe Josh murdered Susan and likely disposed of her body somewhere in the Utah desert. However, nearly a decade removed from the event, we still have no clear answer. In the immediate aftermath of Susan's vanishing, a combination of police scrutiny and skepticism in the courtroom made custody of the couple's children become somewhat of a carousel, with the two boys, Charlie and Braden, bouncing around from Josh's sister Jennifer to Susan's parents, Chuck and Joy, and back to Josh again. But with the arrival of 2012, investigators really turned up the heat on Josh Powell. A custody hearing for the boys resulted in a demand for Josh to take a polygraph in relation to Susan's disappearance, and it came at a time when he was only permitted one supervised visit with the children per week. Backed into a corner, Josh could certainly sense the end was near. So on February 5th, 2012, unable to go on and unwilling to be without his sons, he set in motion a horrific murder-suicide plot designed to claim all of their lives. As a social worker arrived at his rental home with Charlie and Braden, Josh quickly ushered the boys inside before locking the woman out of the house. While she dialed 911, Josh Powell proceeded to unleash unspeakable violence against his sons, attacking them with a hatchet in a blind rage. After causing severe injuries to the head and neck areas of each boy, Josh set the house on fire, at which point everyone inside succumbed to carbon monoxide poisoning before being ravaged by flames. In the end, all was lost, and too many questions remained for the survivors to find peace. So in the absence of truth, we seek answers to heal the pain. We ask why. Why did this happen? Could it have been prevented? What caused these crimes? And yet, the quintessential question of criminal investigation today, as it pertains to psychology, is the pursuit of answering why. But perhaps the better question is how. How did this happen? Asking why reaches down to the core of the emotional values that comprise the answer to our riddle, but it doesn't satisfy structural understanding of human behavior. Josh Powell was a classic sociopath and was spawned from a place where he was genetically and environmentally predisposed to adopting sociopathy to get what he wants, and do so at any cost to others, up to and including death of loved ones, like his wife and children. The sociopath always answers why with a very simple, built-in desire: resources. The sociopath engages antisocial behavior to acquire resources he otherwise can't have. Just like those with a normally functioning brain, the actions he'll take to acquire things he needs will be based upon a conservative approach that renders no more risk than is perceived as necessary for accomplishing the task. Just as murder would be an option of last resort for anybody with a conscience, it remains that way for the sociopath too. The only difference is that most of us draw a line in the sand and don't cross it. If we need to kill somebody to acquire a specific resource, we forego that resource or find an alternative that suffices. Even so, the result is we're often forced to go without the resource. The sociopath makes no such compromise. He simply moves the obstacle preventing success. Therefore, in terms of societal understanding, the why, or more specifically, the reason the crime was committed, never changes. The sociopath wants something and can't have it without resorting to illegal activity. Plain and simple. So, all the sociopath does, in his plight, is abandon evolution for different rules he's concocted to better suit his own circumstances, currently disallowing him to get what he wants. There's no great mystery in that. He commits a crime and subsequently avoids detection by evolution's human watchdog called society. In that light, understanding why these people manipulate and kill has very little practical value. You can be an expert on sociopathic behavior and extend that knowledge to many other people, but fostering understanding is your limitation. In order to prevent the creation of sociopaths in our society, we have to analyze the process of their construction and then make the necessary changes to our behavior to accommodate the new understanding. But sadly, it won't happen. The human brain is constructed to analyze and interpret this faulty behavior, but for the purpose of creating sophisticated operating systems within future artificial intelligence. Notice that our efforts regarding serial killers, and all violent criminals for that matter, are geared toward detection and punishment rather than prevention. The reason is that evolution isn't capable of preventing their existence in the framework of a flesh and blood body coupled with a human intellect. Nature only allows prevention by creation of a new, superior being derived from technology that addresses the negation of antisocial behavior. So, our job, in terms of psychology, sociology, and all other factors related to evolutionary considerations, is to identify the process of formation from genetics to behavior and reverse engineer it to find the seed from which the evil grows. Now, I'd like to tell you this is a complicated process, but in reality, it's not. Everything in society is forced to abide by the two-pronged evolutionary approach of tradition and progress. The only thing you really ever need to understand how life works is to look at a set of train tracks. Or anything else for that matter. I could spend the next hour dissecting the evolutionary implications of a jar of peanut butter, and we would still have ample insight into the reason Josh Powell was a sociopath and how it all came to be. That sounds ridiculous, but the truth is that everything in your world is comprised for the purpose of conformity to evolution. So, all we need to do to identify the point of origin on Josh's antisocial personality disorder is to look for the element in his past where that proverbial train goes off the tracks because the rails are no longer constructed in a two-pronged approach that allows them to not only travel parallel to each other, but simultaneously as well. In that light, just think of a train traveling on the tracks. As long as both tracks are clear and not obstructed or damaged, the train will operate properly. However, if something, such as an object or action, damages the two-pronged approach and causes the train to try to operate in any other way, only two results are possible. Either the conductor sees the train is about to derail and stops, or he doesn't see it, whether due to ignorance or arrogance, and continues. If you stop the train, you no longer have to abide by the two-pronged evolutionary precedent that requires two rails. Stopping, or no longer moving, in terms of evolution, is the equivalent of death. So evolution allows you to die. For instance, you can keep a train car sitting on tracks long after the train will never be used again. In fact, it's a common practice. We find all sorts of retired train cars sitting on unused tracks, covered in graffiti and rust, with plants growing through them. That can continue forever, or at least until the materials with which the train was constructed have crumbled in time. Nature asks nothing in return for stagnancy because lack of movement is synonymous with death. Death utilizes no resources, but movement, or life, requires constant resources. So if a train is moving along the tracks and requires both rails to function properly, it stands to reason you can't fix one of them by stealing material from the other as you end up with the same lack of resources. The answer is creation. More specifically, the creation of technology. If you repair the damaged rail, the train will move again. Yet, if you create a better set of rails with consideration for what caused the damage in the first place, nature will allow you to move more efficiently, whether that means faster, more safely, or by utilizing fewer resources. It could be all of those things. Change that's geared toward efficiency of movement is rewarded by evolution, whether physical or emotional. In my last episode about the Lost Girls of Panama, we examined the fallout from ignoring evolutionary considerations when indulging physical structures. We had two young women leave society for a simple day hike, only to find themselves the victims of an accident that seems as though it was the result of ignoring such things. In that case, we discussed the construction of a monkey bridge, which is a commonly used tool of the local indigenous people who shun modern technology and all associated forms of progress in order to retain a primitive lifestyle conducive to their traditional desires. The young women, on the other hand, came from a technologically progressive European nation that engages evolution. So when the young women were in a position to endeavor a river crossing where the technology of the available monkey bridge was inadequate, an accident likely occurred. Like the train going off the rails due to a damaged track, a monkey bridge only having a single rope span a river for the purpose of walking across also sets you up for failure in the form of a fall or crash that will precipitate death. Either way, the logic is inherent. If you go off the rails in life, nature will stop you. Your job is to continue moving forward while searching for better, more efficient ways of doing so, and then implementing those methods as time passes to create positive change, emotionally and physically. You do that whether you're building a bridge over a river or spanning a gap between your heart and a potential lover. The key to living such a life is simple. If you create, you win. If you take, you lose. A very popular question is often posed among humanity, especially regarding gifts on special occasions. We ask ourselves, quite simply, is it better to give or receive? Some people say receiving is preferable, while others believe giving displays a greater sense of character. In fact, if you ask this question of anyone, you're likely to get an answer that leans toward one or the other, but not both. Yet the truth is that no gift has ever been given without being received, and it is therefore a necessary reciprocal agreement in which the question is worthless. In reality, it's not better to give or receive. It's a cyclical process, and by necessity. One of these things fuels the other, and neither exists in the absence of this symbiotic relationship. Therefore, in terms of how resources are utilized within the context of evolution, we must give and we must take. That means one thing. We have to create. Creation is what allows us to give and take. If you build an air conditioner, you can give yourself and others cool air. If you grow crops, you can feed yourself and others. If you broker a home sale, you can live off the profits while the buyer gets sheltered from the elements. Creation within evolution is divine. It promises power. So within the framework of evolution, we must have a two-pronged approach. Tradition collides with progress, revealing a technological deficiency in the world, which is then eradicated specifically through the means of combining two previously unrelated elements in the form of A, what has existed to this point, aka tradition, and B, what will be born of the desire to transcend that limitation, aka progress. But in order for this to be successful, you must have two halves. The past is our cumulative knowledge and experience. The future is possibility. One without the other causes evolution to go off the rails. Life comes to a halt. Therefore, any relationship within evolution must conform to the same principle. We have to indulge the two-pronged approach of tradition and progress, or past and future, for anything to work properly. The absence of it will derail your train. Literally, figuratively, metaphorically, and every other way you can imagine. So, within that knowledge as our guiding principle, we know it applies to all things. That includes human relationships, especially those geared toward one element. Creation. Two unrelated elements come together, or merge, in order to serve one function, which is the creation of something new that promises technological advance. That something of which we speak could be two people forming a company with an exciting new product, or it could be a marriage intended to produce kids. Either way, however, we must engage this process in the same manner we've written stories since the beginning of time, which is to create something that is universal to humanity's plight, while also being unique to the combination of elements in which the idea was originally cultivated. So in terms of a monkey bridge, you further technology by introducing a second rope to walk on, which runs parallel to the first, just like a train track, thereby realizing the introduction of the second rope allows for the placement of a platform to span them. With the creation of the platform, which was birthed by the merging of two unrelated but similar things in the form of the ropes, what you end up with is the ability to traverse the bridge with greater speed, efficiency, and safety. Knowing that, then, we also understand that when two similar but unrelated people come together for the purpose of romance leading to marriage, that which they create, from their relationship to their children, will only progress within the same set of rules as the monkey bridge. If the parents' actions don't run parallel to each other and in a symbiotic relationship, the train is guaranteed to derail. So if two people come together to produce a child, aka new technology, they must adhere to the two-pronged evolutionary approach of tradition and progress, just like everything else in society. Now, on the surface, this might seem a bit tricky, as we have to consider single parents, LGBTQ couples, and similar situations that don't indulge the cookie-cutter definition of parents, including one man and one woman. Now, in that situation, with a heterosexual man and woman, we simply assign the roles of tradition and progress through biological means. As we've discussed many times on this show, nature sends us messages biologically and intuitively as its primary means of communication in the absence of being able to interact directly through speech. In that context, what we learn is that, biologically, women play the role of tradition in evolution, and men feel the need for progress. That probably sounds a bit odd at first. So, tradition is where we come from, and progress is where we're going. To this point in history, we have all come from women's bodies, even those of us who were conceived in a test tube circa some strange medical experiment in 1987. In some form or another, the creation and growth of a human fetus has to be supported by a woman's body, or at least something that's been extracted from the body. That will change when we destroy evolution. Reproduction will be the result of material replication, not a miracle of nature. At that time, the two-pronged evolutionary approach will quickly prove it's obsolete. In the meantime, however, the creation of humans, aka new technology, originates in women's bodies, making them the traditional arm of that two-pronged evolutionary approach. Of course, that means men are the progressive rail that runs parallel to the traditional rail women utilize. How do we know that? It's pretty simple. In the time that humans have graced the Earth, men are responsible for the overwhelming majority of technology that's been created. In fact, we live in a world where women are just now, in most civilized societies, being perceived as equivalent to men and being afforded opportunities to wield power that was previously almost solely the province of men. And people are angry. It hurts that women were denied basic rights for so long, and that discrimination is actually still alive and well right now in places like the United States. To most people, this process is baffling to an extent we're left with no choice but to generalize men as evil, abusive, and controlling, to the extent that even many men believe the world would be a better place if it was run by women. I'm more than happy to concede a world run entirely by women, as they're perfectly capable of the task, but I refuse to stoop to such nonsensical logic in the process. For instance, I saw a tweet recently made by George Takei, who's been a pretty popular figure in American pop culture, having starred in Star Trek many years ago, among other things. He suggested it's time to let women run the world, because men have done nothing but bring it to the brink of ruin. Now, it's a nice warm fuzzy sentiment on the surface, but from an intellectual standpoint, it's like eating from a dumpster and recommending it to friends as a 5-star restaurant. Men have dominated the world since the beginning of time, because extracting women from professional pursuits, in addition to warfare, has ensured survival of the human species. For instance, in today's world, even if it makes you uncomfortable as a man to have women serving in combat, there isn't a logical argument to prevent them from doing so. However, if we wind the clock back to medieval times, it's pretty clear that sending women out onto the battlefield with a sword is going to have an incredibly detrimental effect on the world's population. Nature isn't stupid. It isn't going to concede such losses. So what it did was create men with an overbearing sex drive in order to maximize reproduction and ensure survival in conditions where men were constantly getting slaughtered. By that same token, it also bestowed men with greater physical strength and athleticism, making it nearly impossible for women to compete on the battlefield in a sword fight against a man. That's all intended as a means of protecting their offspring. But again, if we fast forward to today, a woman could be at the controls of a drone, raining fire all over helpless men on the battlefield, slaughtering them like ants. Her physical strength has absolutely no bearing on the outcome, and in the process, what we also see is that her ability to reproduce isn't compromised at all. So getting back to men being the progressive aspect of a male-female relationship in evolution, the reality is that, for the most part, they've controlled the narrative about where humanity is going since the start. Conquest and technological advance, until recently, were almost exclusively the province of men because they're dangerous activities. Seeking better ways to acquire resources that allow us to move faster and more efficiently is a great way to die, whether you're building a monkey bridge, going to war, or trying to put a brand new spacecraft into orbit. So the old notion of men out in the field, women at home, that primitive manner of thinking, wasn't created or even enforced by men. It's a conspiracy of nature. And notice that conspiracy is starting to crumble. Women have had enough. Men are now in a place where they'll continue to concede their previous advantages in favor of a new, level playing field. Technology has made physical strength nearly obsolete in terms of using it for conquest and control of people and situations. So men will continue to concede control to women as part of preparation for a future where artificial intelligence will eradicate traditional gender roles. Women will become more powerful, and men will shrink down to size, so to speak, in order to create societal acceptance of an androgynous artificial future as a precursor to its actuality. Androgyny will rule the future, as the elimination of evolution, and by extension humanity, will negate the necessity for traditional reproduction brokered by nature. Replication, in addition to the concept of metamorphosis, will permit freedom of movement, or change. The previously known permanence of gender, and even its establishment, will be obsolete. There won't be any need for gender, race, or similar. A move toward equality on all accounts in the civilized world today will prepare our brains for such a future. Notice that there's almost always a correlation between progressive politics and societal change, while conservative politics try to pull back the reins on change. Nature, or evolution, implements this push-pull system for reasons I've discussed many times before, but among the most interesting to me is the fact that we're really just pawns in the game of technology. Change that's allowed in society, by way of politics, happens at approximately the same rate as technological expectations in that particular place. As we move toward a future with rapidly changing technology, the overwhelming desire of humanity to march toward its destiny pushes us toward equality. Some will demand change, some will resist it, but all will be serving nature. It's amazing. So, how that trajectory relates to this case is that it shows us the problems offered by traditional relationships in humanity, specifically reproduction, where two parties are required to create offspring. The traditional means of bringing children to adulthood is to raise them while the two parties attempt to maintain a situation at home that's conducive to the task. Unfortunately, we all know this doesn't end well sometimes. For various reasons, relationships fail, one parent takes off, somebody dies, and the list goes on. Anything can happen. And so the basis for having success in this capacity is compromise. More specifically, you have to make sure that train stays on the tracks, because people often stray. Sometimes they go off the rails. And if they have children, it's contagious. Now, there are generally only two choices one can make in behavior with others, social or antisocial. So, in the context of a sociopath, the road is paved with antisocial behavior. And if it's learned by a child in his household while growing up, it's because his parents encouraged it by way of their marriage going off the rails. Such is the case with Josh Powell. Now, it's hard to say when this story really begins, but what we know for sure is that a tumultuous relationship existed between the parents of Steve Powell, who is Josh's controversial father. Apparently, Josh's grandparents had a nasty split at some point, which resulted in a vicious game between the two for the rights to custody of their kids. On numerous occasions, they both reportedly engaged in kidnapping the children from the other and fleeing. In between, they would pepper the kids with lies about the other parent in order to gain favor and manipulate the situation. At one point, Steve Powell, as a child, was unexpectedly placed in a car with his grandparents and transported to Northern California with only these words from his grandmom: "You'll never see your mother again." But he did. The cycle continued. Abuse, manipulation, lies. It's what he learned. In turn, Steve Powell attempted to raise his own kids that way, and the results were terribly tragic. So what I want to do here is take a look at how this happened. Josh's grandparents took the evolutionary train off the track, so to speak. The family went from the traditional composition of man and woman working together to that same man and woman not only working against each other, but also the best interests of the children, in favor of accommodating their desire to hurt the other. If you throw in the manipulation, lies, and kidnapping, it's exceedingly antisocial. Now, here's the thing. Two parents are obviously not required to raise a child. Two people, apart from each other, whether divorced, separated, or never married, can raise children together because of their common interest. By that same token, a single parent can also keep the train on the rails by adopting the obligations of the missing parent in addition to their current responsibilities. Of course, any other similar arrangement can be successful as well. But if there are two people involved, what's important is cooperation among the two parties to achieve a common goal. Parents going to war against one another with their children used as pawns in some kind of sick game will potentially bestow antisocial narcissistic qualities upon them because the kids will harbor feelings of anger and worthlessness. If you put yourself in front of your kids and hurt people you're supposed to love, specifically family members, your kids might grow up to do the same things. So Steve never had stability, nor was he afforded control of anything in his young life. From one moment to the next, his reality could shift and leave him in despair. It only stands to reason, then, that in his adult life, Steve demanded control of his wife, of the finances, of people's perception of him, and even what constitutes the truth. It was all about him. A true narcissist. He wanted to control the narrative. Because as a child, he never did. He was fed manipulation and lies. And as he'd learned that men and women should work against each other in the raising of children, Steve was doomed to repeat that mistake with his own family. He'll go on to employ manipulation and lies in an effort to antagonize his wife and then gain the allegiance of his children through those same crude methods. But it's nothing more than a cover for his own feelings of anger and worthlessness related to his childhood. He controls the narrative to negate perceived inferiority, primarily his own. The narcissist relies on arrogance, in lieu of confidence, to assert his false sense of worthiness, entitlement, and superiority. This means that anything acting as, or even symbolizing authority in his adult life, will be attacked and suppressed in order to retain control as god of his world, so to speak. The narcissist is never wrong, and his methods are always better. By asserting the inferiority of other sources of authority, his self-worth is elevated. But it's just a smokescreen. Unfortunately, that's all they need to operate. They can allow others to see right through it because they choose to surround themselves most closely with individuals they know can be manipulated to their liking. And this is where it starts to get really ugly in terms of blatant deception. What men know, even if only from an intuitive standpoint, is the concept I just described about them being the progressive half of humanity and evolution, and that unspoken reality boils down to this. In personal relationships, from romance to parenthood, women are more likely to stay and weather the storm during times of hardship. Men are more likely to flee. The word deadbeat dad exists for a reason, as does the reality that many women are forced to raise children on their own because men simply abandon the responsibility. So from a practical standpoint, women are more likely to hang around in unfavorable situations because they've been designed to have greater loyalty to tradition than a man. Unfortunately, that reality lends itself all too well to abusive situations, and women existing within such environments find themselves unable to escape because they're invested. If you don't leave when there are warning signs, it sends a clear message to the narcissist and/or sociopath to escalate those insinuations into increasingly abusive and controlling actions in order to accurately gauge just how invested the victim is at the time. Basically, the man will test the woman with such actions, and if she stays, he will continue to implement more and more controlling measures designed to decrease her influence, independence, and individuality in the home. This process essentially deifies the abuser, making anything he does acceptable and right. The victim becomes so invested in the lifestyle, she feels she can no longer escape. At that point, the victim sees clearly that she's so deep in this mess due to not leaving that even the thought of leaving has become fantasy. It's not possible. That's when the man, intuitively utilizing his progressive nature of being willing to leave, asserts that the victim will have nothing and be nothing without him. As she examines his statement, despite her desire to leave, she'll realize he's correct. Her steadfast willingness to stay drew her into a situation where she couldn't leave. That's how sociopathic men draw women into their personal spiderweb. All the woman has to do for the narcissist to totally crumble is leave the situation. But it's contrary to her nature. So as she climbs into that web, often she's stuck there. Because of this concept, literature throughout the world, in addition to movies, books, and more, is flush with stories about a charming man who suddenly changed once he entered a marriage and became some type of evil tyrant. And we're fascinated with this plot. It's been the basis of too many stories to count, going all the way back to the earliest words placed to paper. And the reason it's so popular in fantasy is because that man's sibling does not exist in reality. It's merely a projection of what seems to happen. In reality, these shitty men were always terrible and simply didn't need to exert much negative energy early in the relationship as they were getting what they wanted without manipulation because they weren't asking for much. As the expectations of another person rise over time in such a relationship, just like they do in a normal relationship, the sociopath or narcissist will employ the same. At the beginning of a relationship, we generally value the feeling of excitement that comes with something new, especially love and all of its associated gifts, from intellectual stimulation to sex to hope for the future. New relationships offer abundant rewards and don't require significant amounts of work on the part of either party. However, once that honeymoon stage is over, extending the relationship into the future requires work, sacrifice, and compromise. When these things creep into the picture, the sociopath begins to show his true colors. He wasn't fooling anyone or being dishonest previously, however. He didn't change from a good person to a bad one, as we often depict in fictional stories, in addition to real life as well. He was always the same person. But as the sociopath ages into adulthood and enters relationships that require him to relinquish his resources for others, including time, love, affection, money, and more, he's not interested. He doesn't want to give. He wants to take. Until this point in the relationship, all he had to do was show up. When we meet someone, our presence is all it takes to make them happy at the start of a relationship. But a woman, if she wants to be with a man over the long term, will soon take action to answer a pertinent question. Will he stay? She's going to test him. And that test is based in one idea, which is simply this: investment. Will he invest in our future? In the future of our kids? In the prosperity of the family? And so on. But all of those questions form a terrifying idea for a sociopath. Commitment. When you commit, you must stay. Staying means surrendering your right to control and indulging sacrifice. And doing that means engaging tradition. In nature, We have two responses to the behavior of others, fight or flight. Just like tradition and progress, women represent fight while men represent flight. Even back to the times of people living in caves and talking around campfires, men engaged flight by leaving their homes, venturing into the great unknown, into the dangers beyond what they knew, and then returned with the rewards, whether it was material wealth, food, or the acquisition of new land. Of course, they often died, too. Meanwhile, women were inclined to offer stability and consistency at home, ensuring the survival and prosperity of children, even in times of war, plague, or famine. Thousands of years later, we're still struggling to understand why men are so predisposed to abandoning their home lives while women are so inclined to stay. It isn't a secret. We've been designed by nature, or evolution, to accommodate. Fault lies within our construction and not our choices. The sociopath is intentional. If we look at the abuse victim, in addition to the sociopath, they're both suffering. Neither gets what they want, and they can't agree. But they want the same thing. Control. The flaw in our design is apparent with that notion. Control is not possible for the individual within the confines of evolution and its two-pronged approach to reproductive success. We must rely on the actions of others to achieve our goals. That's a risky proposition. Synchronicity between intellects constructed with opposing values of tradition and progress is essentially an emotional impossibility. That means the same values utilized in warfare will also exist in your household. Yet, that's exactly the intention of nature. Just as I described evolution as being opposing switchbacks that lead up the mountain of any problem, climbing specifically by way of conflict that sends them in opposite directions, before meeting back in the middle, our personal relationships work exactly the same. And that's how abusive relationships become so easily misunderstood. We tend to believe one person or the other changed, but it's almost never true. The fact of the matter is that, once a couple goes to war, as all couples do to build a future involving investment, compromise, and sacrifice, the sociopath, or abuser, will instead seek to be victorious over his partner. He will seek control, a dictatorship. He does this because women, by nature, are predisposed to not abandoning ship. This is why we have such great empathy and respect for women who are able to walk away from abusive relationships when they're fully invested. In order to do the right thing, they have to go against their nature. It's extremely difficult. Evolution has designed women to be predisposed to feeling as though leaving is an act of betrayal, even when it takes place in an abusive relationship. But the secret the abuser holds is that he's truly powerless, and his greatest fear is that she'll expose the truth. That happens by leaving, and specifically for this reason. Change. The thing the sociopath fears most about the people he abuses and controls is that they'll grow stronger, change, and see him for what he is. Powerless. The abuser makes the abused party feel entirely powerless to bring her down to the level of what he's experiencing. He knows courage and confidence precipitates action, and action precipitates change, something he's incapable of harnessing in his own life. Unable to change, mature, and move on from being like this, meaning the act of being a grown child, he has no choice but to keep the abused party in the same place emotionally. But if she finally summons the courage and desire for change that he lacks, she'll see him for what he is. And once the sociopath is exposed, his previously successful techniques, geared toward control of the victim, will be rendered impotent, leaving him helpless to any solution other than choosing change or doubling down on abuse. When a woman leaves an abusive man, he intuitively realizes his actions must become more extreme in a very specific way, which is to institute greater powers of persuasion that will satisfy the plight of regaining control. He asks himself, very simply, how can I get her to stay? But refuses to indulge change as a solution. So, that question becomes something more akin to this. How far do I need to go to prevent her from leaving me? with the reality being that the abuser can't achieve control through manipulation, lies, or even physicality, the word stay begins to take on a more traditional meaning that equates to this. If I've lost control of her and can't have her anymore, how do I still keep her from fleeing? The answer is to kill her. It's the only decisive move one can make to gain control. That's how we end up with this common notion. If I can't have her, no one will. And that entire process I've just discussed is prevalent in this case, from start to finish. Steve Powell, Josh's father, is an abusive, narcissistic sociopath hell-bent on preventing his wife from gaining the courage to leave him. But she does anyway. Accordingly, he raises his sons to become the same type of abuser, yet, by default of the circumstance, instills them with the truth that their sociopathic endeavors will ultimately fail unless they go to greater extremes than Dad to control women. Sadly, but predictably, the plan works to perfection. Josh Powell learns this lesson. His wife, Susan, must be controlled, and at any cost, up to and including death. Even more tragically, with Steve teaching his kids that control over your children is also imperative to the process, we soon learn Josh takes this lesson to heart. So the line, "If I can't have you, no one will," extends to the rest of the family. Accordingly, Josh kills his children so nobody else can have them. And if we examine the fallout from the way Steve Powell raised Josh and his siblings, we learn the truth that the majority of Josh's siblings, under their father's influence, succumb to mental illness, suicide, murder, or a combination of those things. And the road they traveled to get there is antisocial personality disorder. The narcissistic sociopathic values instilled in Steve Powell as a child through his parents' vicious games becomes a staple of the behavior he teaches his kids. He gives them the misguided advice that women are to be controlled and silenced. In the end, that narcissism not only killed him, but everything he loved. Which brings us to the terrifying point of all of this. The sociopath only loves himself, and even that's a lie. In reality, he's a child without a parent, trapped. So he behaves like a scared child in an adult world, refusing maturity and avoids the endgame with control. But when the loss of power comes, truth is revealed. The sociopath is never more dangerous. Once exposed, he needs to be caged. Unfortunately for Charlie and Braden, Josh's sons, society is still blind to that. In this case, Josh Powell will be deemed a fit father by some asshole with a clipboard and a piece of paper on the wall that claims he's an expert in psychiatry. And those kids will end up dead in service of pride. Josh Powell was absolutely never fit to be a father, not before his wife disappeared, and certainly not after. So, why? Why do we still leave children in the hands of predators because they haven't killed them yet? I mean, are you fucking kidding me? Giving a psychiatric evaluation to a sociopath defies logic in every possible way. Of course he's going to tell you what you want to hear. That's what they do. They manipulate, lie, and control. So why do we deem them fit as parents when giving bullshit answers being read from stock questions that couldn't be easier to answer in the manner expected of you, even if you're lying? It's insane. A psychiatric evaluation should consist of analyzing actions, not words. It's pretty damn obvious when somebody is batshit crazy, embedded in psychosis, and incapable of caring for children. That can be established with a few questions and a piece of paper. But when the subject in question appears to be no less than a manipulative, narcissistic sociopath whose behavior is clearly and abundantly antisocial and abusive, yet born of rational thought, the measuring stick has to change. It isn't good enough to say he seems okay. His actions say he was a killer. Anyhow, let's jump into the timeline of events here, starting with Steve and his wife Terry marrying in 1973, so we can identify the warning signs along the way. What I'd like to do is examine both sides of the coin, so to speak, looking not only at the horrific and manipulative behavior of Steve Powell, and by extension, his son Josh, as they span a spectrum of sociopathy from mild to extreme measures, but also dissect the nature of the women who stay with them despite the abuse. Now, this generally puts a person at the risk of being accused of victim blaming, but I happen to believe the backlash against analyzing victims' actions is normally unwarranted. It should go without saying that any person who's been murdered is a victim and didn't actively precipitate that result through their actions. At the same token, examining the psyche of the victim promotes a great deal of societal understanding because it answers that magic question I posed. How did this happen? Why is easy to answer? Josh and Steve were sociopaths. They manipulated resources to get what they wanted and stopped at nothing in a singular pursuit. But when we ask why, it's easy to see that it takes two to tango. Murder can be a solo mission, but maintaining a family in the context of marriage and kids takes two. Unfortunately, we often ignore the female victim in these cases beyond the point of being empathetic. We call the sociopath or killer a maniac, scumbag, or similar, and wish him the fires of hell while extending blind empathy to the victim, which is wonderful in terms of fostering empathy and creating awareness of the problem. But what that process inhibits is understanding. We don't understand the process by which the victim became entangled in this mess for fear of offending someone who feels only empathy should be applied in such situations. In my mind, however, this information related to the victim's actions is just as important as comprehension of the killer's MO. Evolutionary processes require tradition and evolution, so as important as it is to understand how the man, or perpetrator, descended to the depths of hell emotionally, it's equally important to understand how the woman got there as well. Such a relationship can't exist without the cooperation of two parties. So we have to ask difficult questions. Why did Steve Powell's wife, Terry, stay at his side, married, for nearly two decades, while continuing to have more of his children, even after he'd long since proven himself an abusive, narcissistic man-child who essentially believed women should slave for men and receive nothing in return? How could she live that way? And then there's Susan Powell. Her husband, Josh, was much lazier, more controlling, and if it's even possible, more abusive than his father. In examining Josh Powell extensively, I was not able to uncover a single element of his existence that would be attractive to a woman. He hated women, hated working, neglected his children, kept his wife's income entirely for himself, and withheld affection at all costs. He believed she should be the breadwinner, take care of the children, and complete all of the household chores, while he didn't do anything at all. Notice the amount of responsibility he's willing to assume is equivalent to a small child. He creates a wife in the likeness of a mother and expects to get everything he wants, whenever he wants, while contributing nothing to the household except a demand to be righteous in that endeavor. That's what a small child does. The sociopath is just a man who refuses to grow up. What he really wants is a mother who will take care of him in adulthood, but is forced to indulge that desire by taking a wife and leveraging manipulation and abuse as a means of achieving that goal. If the sociopath can get the woman to treat him like a small child, it's a smashing success. Once she accepts his controlling behavior and unreasonable demands, she's his mom, not his wife. And we know women rarely abandon kids. So the success of the sociopath in a marriage between man and woman is predicated upon the sociopath's ability to have his wife allow him the reasoning abilities of a small child, in the sense that he can whine and pout to gain control. A normal adult relationship is based in respect, specifically for the actions of the other person being conducive to your own, and representing that second rail in the tracks that allows the train to move ahead safely and without ever derailing. The sociopathic male, however, controls the household by extracting a woman's intuition to be a mother to her children through manipulation, for his own purposes. The sociopath simply becomes one of the children emotionally and forces the woman to give him things he hasn't earned, or he'll turn into a tyrant, just like a small child would. Once she's entrenched in that mindset, her allegiance to him will be the same as it is to her children. This is why, when Josh refuses to work, hoards Susan's hard-earned paycheck for himself, won't have sex with her, and can't even bring himself to kiss her on the lips, she continues to love and support him, unquestionably, because he's a child. None of those things are expected of him, and this pattern of mental illness will continue for the woman until she abandons her evolutionary disposition that drives her to stay instead of leave. She stays because mothers simply don't abandon their children very often. The sociopath knows this and becomes one to manipulate the genetic predisposition. Sadly, the fact remains that all kids grow up. That's where the sociopath eventually loses in his dealings with such vulnerable women. He believes the control can continue into perpetuity, and just for the asking. But as the woman's real kids mature, it's only natural to see the same progression in her man-child husband. When he refuses, and she notices her children maturing while her husband doesn't, the pendulum starts to swing back the other way. Instead of seeing the man-child husband as a kid worthy of her unflinching support, she'll start to see him as what he is, a man who doesn't want to grow up. When this happens, it's very unnatural, as all kids grow up. Mothers know that intuitively. And that's when the manipulation becomes wholly apparent to the woman. Once it happens, and the message is delivered intuitively, she knows her relationship with her husband, the man-child, is an abomination of evolutionary intention. That's when the abused woman finally engages the flight response and finds the courage to leave, specifically at the point she realizes her husband will never grow up. Until then, she desperately holds on to hope that he'll change, because the whole point of nurturing children is to bring them to maturity, to a time when they can go out on their own and be successful without using parental resources. It took Steve's wife, Terry, nearly 20 years to come to this realization, despite the fact that Steve's behavior was absolutely deplorable and childish from the start. It took Steve's wife, Terry, nearly 20 years to come to this realization, despite the fact that Steve's behavior was absolutely deplorable and childish from the start. On the same note, Susan Powell was 7 or 8 years deep into her marriage and only just starting to scratch the surface regarding the truth about her husband's motivations, despite the fact he offered nothing from money to affection. She was riding a bike several hours to work and back every day, cleaning the house, feeding the kids, doing laundry, and accommodating everything else you could imagine. Meanwhile, Josh is not working, controlling her paycheck, and unable to offer any type of reasonable explanation for why a one-sided arrangement is fair. To take it a step further, both Terry and Susan, upon the realization that the marriages weren't working, instituted a plan to get pregnant again, and did. In fact, both mothers even talked about having another child, in addition to those already in the family, all while being the recipients of constant abuse from their husbands. When they should have been fleeing, they were making plans to stay. That's because, as stated earlier, women compromise the traditional half of the evolutionary reproductive process. They're going to be predisposed to finding a reason to stay, rather than a reason to flee. Nature has designed their brains this way in order to provide maximum protection to their offspring. But the sociopath infiltrates that strong sensibility with manipulation to use it to his advantage. If she has another kid and the father is already irresponsible, the mother will simply increase her level of responsibility. And because she's designed to not abandon the child that results, what happens is the addition to the family solidifies the abuser's control. Now she's even more desperate for him to change because there are more children to accommodate. It's a vicious cycle that often ends badly. But no matter how it ends, there's one thing we can say in this case, for sure. The worst situation is for the kids to be taken from mom and placed with dad. That's what happens here, not only among Terry and Steve during Josh's childhood, but again with Susan and Josh in their subsequent marriage. And guess what happens? Steve's sons all become sociopaths under his influence. As the courts were going to take Josh's boys years later, their fate was cemented too. Because of that grandiose, narcissistic motto, "If I can't have you, nobody will." That happened due to the fact that sociopaths see all resources as their own. Seeing all resources as your own gives you the right to create and destroy at will. This is the power of God, the control narcissistic, sociopathic men falsely employ. So, I think what's incredibly important to societal understanding of these matters is recognizing the formation of evolutionary abominations disguised as marriage. A marriage is a union in which two parties support each other by working together toward common goals. As the sociopath only has goals geared toward his own desires, anyone entering marriage with him will be serving that notion exclusively. So, going all the way back to 1973 here, the first thing to examine are the reasons Terry provides for why she fell in love with Steve and decided to marry him. Terry says Steve was an upstanding young man who was active in the church and had big dreams and plans for the future. On the surface, that sounds like a great thing, but let's look a little more closely at what we have here. When Steve was married in 1973, he'd have been about 21 or 22 years old. Now, at that time, it was far more common for couples to marry at a young age and do so without extensive courtships. By today's standards, a couple might start dating at 27, marry at 31, and have kids several years after, and that would seem perfectly normal. Inflation, the skyrocketing cost of education, and other similar factors had given the act of finding a lifetime partner a more deliberate pace. In 1973, a couple would have had a better chance of making a sufficient living with entry-level jobs. But in today's market, we find young people taking multiple roommates to cut costs and waiting to indulge marriage until a time when it's more financially feasible. The benefit of such a thing, aside from financial considerations, is that each partner, upon considering whether or not to be with the other long-term, has the ability to gauge that person's performance as an adult. So if you're a 28-year-old woman, and your boyfriend of the same age is lazy, rude, and controlling while refusing to work, there's no need to project what type of man he's going to become. You already know he's not worthy of your hand in marriage, and can leave without getting hurt in the process of finding out the hard way. Unfortunately, if that guy is only 21 or 22, and your experiences with him are more reflective of his youth rather than his adulthood, you really don't know what kind of man you're going to get. You have to predict that future based upon the information currently available. What makes that so difficult is that children, including teens and even those in college, have not been forced to make many adult choices to this point in their lives, and so you don't know how they'll react to the oncoming pressures of career and family. Their experiential resume doesn't include hardship absent of the help of others. They've had parents, teachers, siblings, and members of the church assisting them with everything. So in those situations, a woman is clearly going to project into the future and ask, "What type of man am I getting?" It's a great question, but one that needs to be answered by way of the man's actions and never his words. Moreover, it needs to be placed in the context of adult action and not that of a child. What I mean specifically is that, as a child, teen, or student, that which you indulge in terms of hard work related to your future is all about you. You don't have a family. You reap all the rewards for yourself at that time. It's all about what you want. When you plan a life with somebody else, much of that hard work will go toward what they want. And that's why it makes so much sense to have common goals. If you're both working toward the same things, sacrifices you make for each other will be worthwhile. So Steve was a Mormon in his teen years, a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, in which he was supposedly an active member who even served a mission. This impressed Terry and made her feel Steve was going to be a good man because of his willingness to serve others. But the reality is he did this as a teen and not as an adult. Teens are under the control of parental figures, and often their actions, no matter how willingly they're employed, are nothing more than the projection of their parents' desires. I mean, if your parents send you to church, you go. If they want you to go on a mission, that's what you do. If we look at Steve's home life as a child, Clearly he had no sense of stability and had quite a bit of anger about his parents using him as a pawn in their kidnapping game. The church was obviously agreeable to him during that time because it offered stability, a sense of belonging, and power when he was powerless. And again, it's agreeable to him at that time because he's under the control of others. He's not an adult. He can't just walk out and never come back. So he gets away however he can. He serves in the church. He goes on a mission. But only for now. In a few years, Steve will be an adult who answers to nobody and makes his own choices. At that point, he can escape the problems however he likes, whether it's drugs, alcohol, moving to another country, or anything else for that matter. When he meets Terry, though, he's only just coming out of his childhood and adolescence to indulge adulthood. So Terry looks at his choice of attending church, which wasn't actually his choice, and thinks that's who he is. But he did that in the context of being under the control of parental figures, not as an adult. In addition, his big plans and dreams for the future are not actions, they're simply desires. So when Terry says she's married him because he had big plans and dreams, the reality is that there was no action in place to back up that claim. It's what Steve told her, and she believed him, but there was no proof in the pudding. The reality here is that Steve suffered loss of control, instability, anger, anxiety, and a host of other issues stemming from his home life as a boy. He had years of experience with those things, not with understanding them, but suffering them. If his first act as an adult is anything but enacting a plan to eradicate the damage caused by these issues, and forming a strong foundation contrary to that abuse, one in which he, his wife, and children will be able to thrive, his marriage will be a disaster. Not surprisingly, that's what it becomes, because he'll be forced to live in the past every second of every day until he addresses those issues. The only alternative is to do nothing, to allow those feelings of hopelessness and anger to continue to fester in his mind, and then project the misery upon his wife and kids as an act of pseudo-revenge for what happened to him in his childhood. So for Terry, the right move here is to ask this question. Is this man doing anything to heal the wounds caused by his parents in the past? And if that answer is no, then Steve is clearly going to be the abusive, shitty parent his parents both were to compensate for the fact his feet are still stuck in the mud. If he won't free himself from the past, he'll anchor himself to it and live there. Unfortunately for Terry and the kids, they'll drown with him until he changes. But he never will, because Steve Powell was always a sociopath. The lesson? Don't marry a boy. Marry a man. You'll already know who he is by his adult choices. What he did as a teen, or even before, means nothing. It was all influenced by others. The true measure of a man's willingness to give to others and make sacrifices should already be inherent in his adult choices. If his actions are clearly contrary to his words, he's still a child. For better or worse, he'll remain selfish. Terry, like Susan after her, will become enamored with a man due to his potential rather than the reality of what he is. The mistake in that is not choosing a man for his potential, but choosing him for potential that isn't combined with hard work. If a man says he has dreams for the future, it should be in conjunction with effort. If a man doesn't work hard for himself, he'll never work hard for his family when they arrive. And that's the reality here. Steve Powell was a bullshit con artist. He didn't work hard and certainly didn't have the ambition to back up his empty words. So as we previously deduced that women, from an evolutionary standpoint, are more inclined to adhere to the traditional principle of staying rather than leaving, the next phase of that process is a familiar one that makes us all cringe, I'm sure. And that concept is fixing. A woman in a relationship with a sociopath, aka man-child, will first realize the problem and then internalize the prospective solution as one related to motherhood, essentially seeing the man-child as a kid that needs to be fully supported. The desire to fix the man-child is akin to the act of raising an actual little boy, wherein you support him entirely while he grows up over time as a normal kid would. But he doesn't. By then, though, it's too late. The woman only leaves once she sees her own children sprout to adulthood around her, while her man-child husband remains immature. At that point, nature sends the message to her biologically that this is an abomination of evolutionary process, and that tied to the desire to raise and fix is broken. There's no going back from that. This is why we get women who will inexplicably stay with a horrible man for a very long time, and then suddenly, with seemingly no apparent explanation, decide she's done, and she means it. It's like a light switch flipped. The sociopath can't handle this. It ruins him. Steve and Josh both end up dead because they decided to play their cards and string out the sociopathy to the end. The reason this process happens, why a woman reaches that moment of fuck this, I'm out, is because once she sees the man as a child who can't be raised or fixed, she then only perceives him as a child. And a child can't be your husband. So the act of staying and trying to fix a man-child, to raise him to adulthood, so to speak, is what keeps women invested in abusive relationships. At the core of this idea is a sneaky little trick being played out by nature. What it's doing is manipulating women into raising children who are already grown, but won't act like it, by plugging into their desire to succeed at motherhood. In this case, Terry and Susan are both very loving, nurturing people who care deeply for their kids. Sociopathic men, in turn, behave like children so they can fully consume the woman's resources without reciprocation. Like a small child, they make demands and offer nothing in return but the right to continue to care for them until they grow up one day. It mimics childish behavior. But the thing is, they don't grow up. That means the hourglass turns the moment the sociopath indulges this concept. It has a shelf life. Day by day, the woman, though she puts up with his behavior now, will become increasingly tired of it as time goes on. This happens with children, but they mature and leave the home, so the breaking point never arrives. Yet, if your son lives at home until he's 30, guess what's going to happen? At some point, the situation is going to come to a head. He'll be asked to grow up. That's what happens to Steve Powell. The same goes for his son, Josh. The result? Murder. You have a choice when partnering with a sociopath. You can pave the way for him with your resources and defer to his control, or you can stand in the way of those resources and get steamrolled for the effort. Terry will just barely make it out of the way before it's too late. Susan isn't so lucky. So, Steve doesn't waste any time in putting his plan into effect. 1 year after he marries Terry in 1973, the couple welcomes their first child, Jennifer, into the world. Terry's described as someone who was a peacekeeper and wanted others to be happy. That's wonderful, but dangerous within a marriage to a sociopath. About a year and a half later, in January 1976, Josh is born. Only 1 year after that, another son, John, is also born. In addition to these births, there were also reportedly several miscarriages. So in the first 3 years of marriage, they produced three children, and as the product of relentlessly attempting to do so. Which again, is great if you work hard, earn good money, and wish to care for children. But Steve Powell suggests that caring for children is women's work, and so his wife is left to handle the household, as well as the couple's three young kids. There's this rush to get the kids into the world, but no rush to do anything to raise them properly. Steve wants nothing to do with it. They're already stuck in a vicious cycle. So Terry thinks she's anchoring Steve by having kids, and that he's going to grow up and fulfill all these big dreams to accommodate. But he's not. So he needs to control the narrative to adjust her expectations. That means she can't be influenced by outsiders who obviously see the truth about her husband. In fact, their daughter Jennifer says her mom became aware of Steve's issues in the first year or two of their marriage. And look what she does. She goes full force at doing everything she can to invest herself in the relationship further by having more kids. Steve knows this is what she wants to try to anchor him to responsibility, but also realizes all she's doing is putting herself deeper in a hole she can't escape. She thinks the solution is putting him in a position where he'll have to respond and work harder, but he knows all he has to do is ignore caring for the new child, and she'll do it herself. The sociopath chooses a partner to accommodate his unwillingness, specifically in the form of doing work that doesn't benefit him directly. Anything related to sacrifice and nurture will be ignored by this monster. Only his own interests will be at the forefront of his activities. So whenever Terry asks Steve for help, or even when his daughter Jennifer wants to spend time with her dad, he simply says he can't because he's building a business. Not surprisingly, Josh will do the same thing to Susan throughout their marriage. In fact, when Josh's first son is born, he refuses to go to the hospital with his wife because he's busy working at home on his laptop. He arrives hours late with his laptop, still working, and has to be explicitly told to go in and see the kid after he's born. Josh never shows interest in doing so until being pressured by his father-in-law. So even at a young age, the absence of a father's disciplinary influence clearly would have affected Josh and his siblings. But that problem is only going to get worse because there's something hanging over Steve and Terry's marriage that's causing Steve severe mental anguish. He desires full control of his family, but his wife is loyal to the LDS Church, putting her faith at the forefront of their lives. And it's not like that's a surprise. That's who Terry was before they got married. Furthermore, Steve was also active in the church and went on a mission, so it's baffling to his spouse when he suddenly begins to speak negatively about their fate. Of course, it's not difficult to figure out why Steve's animosity grows. If you remember my previous sentiment about adult action as opposed to the same actions taken by a kid, the difference is that adults have to sacrifice for others. So, not only does the church hold a great deal of influence in Terry's life, an influence she also wants for her children, but the Mormon faith is predicated upon a sense of community based in giving back, from work to time to money. Within that revelation, we learn that the Powell family had to pay something called tithing to the LDS Church, which amounted to 10% of their total income. Now, I'm guessing I don't have to tell you how Steve is going to react to the notion of perpetually giving a portion of his paycheck to an authority that has influence over him, his wife, and children. Sociopaths don't relinquish resources without personally and directly benefiting from doing so. Even then, they often steal. So, the church wants money and control from a sociopath. It ain't happening. It's around this time Steve also slips up, and his wife learns he's addicted to porn. But nothing changes. Steve does what he wants, ignoring care of the children and focusing on personal pursuits. Unbeknownst to Terry, Steve also becomes infatuated with a local woman and writes hundreds of pages in a journal about his love for her. But Terry ignores the porn issue and ignores the obsession. Another common behavior for Steve was to expect his children to know how to behave without discipline, as though they'd intuitively know what he wanted. He'd let them play and do whatever they wanted in hopes their behavior would be reflective of his desires, almost as though he was God, some invisible but omnipotent presence. Obviously, children don't possess intuition based on extensive experience, so they need to be told their behavior is poor to realize it. But Steve is a sociopath. For all intents and purposes, again, he's God, at least in his mind. So even though they're children making mistakes, he thinks of them as God's children in the same way you might perceive an adult. He doesn't see the kid as oblivious or ignorant. He sees them as disrespectful. So what Steve would do is just allow the unfavorable behavior to continue while his anger boiled over. Then he would explode on the kids, always verbally, but sometimes physically as well. And they would have no idea why this happened. Of course, they also don't learn anything that way, except that their father is intended to be feared. These tirades would become violent, with Steve spanking the kids too hard dragging them around the room, calling them names, and otherwise terrorizing them. According to Jennifer, Josh found himself on the wrong end of this situation more frequently than the other kids because he was very strong-willed. She also suggested the abuse he suffered during a stretch of several years was a daily occurrence. His dad really had it out for him. Of course, there's no secret in this recipe. In abusive situations, the person who resists the most suffers the worst abuse. Now, we really get a great snapshot of Steve's intentions in the household through one particular truth that shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone. Jennifer, Josh, and John, the three siblings who experienced this early abuse, all became bedwetters. Of course, this is fairly common among victims of abuse, and I generally believe it's little more than the physical manifestation of the concept of lack of control. As a small child, you spend a couple years peeing yourself and then learn to control that urge in order to satisfy your parents. Relieving yourself is the first form of control learned as a child, and we basically accumulate fears about it at a very young age. We all know the interactions between parents and small children who are getting potty trained. Sometimes there's shame, a sense of failure, anger, and so on. It's not easy for either party. So when little kids are faced with irreconcilable emotional issues related to control, such as their father's tyrannical behavior, which offers no rational escape, they work through the problem on a subconscious level in their dream life. As a result, the fear of loss of control is physically correlated to the only thing they've learned to control in their lives so far, meaning when and where they relieve themselves. As the father creates an abusive situation that offers no control for them, even when conforming to what he wants, the child realizes that he's unable to satisfy the demands and truly controls nothing. Therefore, the idea, that failure, manifests in the only thing they can control and forces them to lose control of that too. Because the kids were being punished for losing control of their behavior, but did so in ignorance as Steve refrained from discipline until he exploded, they subconsciously realized that they have no control over anything. So at that point, the truth is symbolized by having them lose control of the only thing they've ever been able to control, which is the worst thing that could happen. Because if they pee their beds, Steve will perceive that he has no control over them. And as the problem is caused by the kid's lack of control, the one thing we can count on to make the situation worse is Steve feeling slighted by the fact he can't control that and attempting to assert a greater degree of control. If that sounds irrational, it certainly is, but it's also true. It's exactly what he does. So let's get out the emotional mirror now. If Steve has to punish the kids for wetting their beds, and do so irrationally, in addition to a manner in which he can seemingly gain control, what is he going to do? It's easy. The emotional mirror tells us to find the mirrored reflection of the truth about what Steve is doing. So if the kids wet the bed with warm liquid while sleeping and are perceived by their father as doing so because they're out of control and are disobeying his desire for control, what he's going to do then is wake them and torture them with the opposite reality that satisfies his desire for omnipotence. Accordingly, each time they do this, Steve fills the bathtub with ice-cold water, submerges them up to their necks, and lets them suffer the physical and emotional fallout until he believes they'll listen and not disobey him again by peeing the bed. But it's irrational. They can't comply. No matter what, this will reflect the cyclical nature of mental illness. Steve's reaction is fueling the problem, not preventing it. The reality is that he can't stop his children from peeing their beds by terrorizing them. He perpetuates the issue simply because it allows him to not change and blame everybody else. Of course, Steve described this activity as a, quote, cure for the problem. It never was. So the behavior inside the home was significantly abusive at that time. However, the worst was yet to come. In a preview of the antisocial onslaught to come later, Steve takes his daughter Jennifer on a business trip that involves a hotel stay. He puts on a kids' movie she can enjoy as the two get into bed, but halfway through it, he suddenly changes the channel without warning. On the screen, Jennifer sees porn. People are having sex. Being a small child, she looks to her father in horror, and he simply returns a blank look before turning away and enjoying the show. Jennifer buries herself under the covers, hoping it's just a dream. But what's to follow is nothing less than a living nightmare. There would be nowhere to hide. Soon after, Steve makes the decision that he's not going to pay tithing to the church. He won't give them 10% of his income and badmouths them to justify his actions as being their fault. Terry, on the other hand, remains steadfast in her dedication to the church. She takes on little odd jobs, sells appliances, and different types of knickknacks to make a buck. That allows her to pay 10% of any money she brings in, which causes Steve to become infuriated as he can't control her loyalty to the LDS Church, nor can he control those resources. His wife is permitted freedom. So Steve ramps up his efforts to rid his family of the LDS Church. And it works. Steve becomes so abusive about religion that Terry abandons her faith for 3 years. She doesn't attend church, pay tithing, or even have prayer before a meal at the dinner table at home, which is exactly what Steve wants. But it's all a lie. Terry truly believed that denouncing her religion would make her husband happy, but it never had anything to do with religion. It was strictly about control. Steve's behavior doesn't change. So Terry finally sees this as a failed experiment and tells him she's not only returning to the church, but taking the kids back with her too. Steve is livid about this, but soon after finds himself failing in real estate, leaving him short on rent 1 month. Terry suggests they pay tithing to the church, and perhaps that will bring them the money they need by way of karma. And it happens. Steve gambles by paying the tithing and sells a home days later, which brings him the money to pay the rent. Terry sees this as a pivotal event, but she doesn't realize she's dealing with a sociopath. He reacted to the opportunity to get what he wants, not to the opportunity to bring the church's influence back into his family. Once he had the resources to pay his rent, he denounced the church again. That's when Terry gave up on that method. He wouldn't change. So Terry will revert to her old methods, which are the concepts of staying and anchoring. She should have left, but she decides to stay and try to anchor Steve, once again, by having her first child in 5 years since John was born. The time in between she tried change as a solution to Steve's problems, but it didn't work. So that 5-year stalemate essentially becomes a purgatory in which they can't live. With Terry deciding to return to the church, Steve decides it's time for the gloves to come off. There will be no other entity in control of his wife or children. There will be no outside influence. And if anyone tries, they'll feel Steve Powell's wrath. So Steve blames everything that goes wrong in his life, or even in the world, on the LDS Church, right about the time his wife returns to restore her faith in it. And what makes him blow his lid over that fact is that she takes the children with her. Meanwhile, Terry employs staying and anchoring in her arsenal to combat Steve. In the next couple years, the Powell family will welcome babies Michael and Alina. But this method backfires on Terry. Steve merely tells her she's worthless because she doesn't bring a significant paycheck home, despite raising 5 young children. That's when Terry finds a notebook under Steve's bed that suggests he's madly in love with a local woman who's happily married and oblivious to his obsession. He goes on to detail sexual fantasies about her in his writings. When confronted by his wife, he doesn't apologize or express regret. There's not even shame. He tells her it's true, and that he's willing to be involved in polygamy to get a second wife. Fed up, Terry finally summons the courage to ask her father to come stay with them for a while. But we know where this is going. Nobody is going to undermine Steve's authority. So one day while Grandpa is out running errands, Steve gathers all of his belongings, tosses them on the lawn, and proceeds to tell the man to get lost. But in the process, Terry decides she's finally had enough of this shit. Terry lays down the law to Steve, telling him she's done with his behavior, from the other woman to the hatred for the church. She says she expects him to clean up his act, or else she's leaving and taking the kids. So Steve has no choice but to agree. Yet Terry believes it's because he wants to. In reality, he'll pretend for a while until she becomes reinvested with their two youngest children arriving. Because he's a sociopath. He can't change. He doesn't want to. But he can manipulate and lie. He's happy to do that to get what he wants. So, he agrees. But the devil lies in wait. Before long, Steve will be up to his old tricks. He just needs to formulate his plan. And what comes to him is the pain from the open wound that caused this mess. His childhood, the vicious game where he was alternately dragged back and forth between allegiance to his mother and father. With nothing else to rely on, Steve descends back into that darkness, taking his wife and children with him. In the process of gaining the loyalty of his kids over their mother, Steve teaches them everything he knows about life and how to live. Unfortunately for Josh Powell, those lessons equate to a manual for creating a sociopath. And in the worst of ways, he'll know the pain of becoming his father. So in part two, we'll examine Josh's adolescence, in addition to his early adult years when he meets Susan Powell, his future wife, and the mother of his two children. In the meantime, I want to close this out with a thought about the people involved in this case. Some of them, like Josh, who allegedly murdered his wife Susan years later, or his father Steve, who was imprisoned for taking numerous photos of unsuspecting women and girls, were perpetrators. But despite that, a sickening truth lies beneath, one that shows everyone in this story, at one time or another, was an abuse victim. And so, before they were tyrants, they were kids. Trapped in a bad place, a nightmare, and they couldn't wake up. So it followed them into their adulthood. They could never run fast enough or far enough away. And so, as I said earlier, that the best stories start as a seed and grow outward from the individual's life into society as a whole, the same applies to this case. Steve Powell abused Josh, his siblings, and their mother because he was abused. In turn, Josh abused his wife Susan, allegedly murdered her, and ultimately killed his own children with a hatchet and carbon monoxide because he was a sociopath. And he was a sociopath because his father was one. And given the nature of the kidnapping game Steve's parents played, it doesn't sound like this illness was exclusive to the following generations. It sounds like a societal crisis. Abuse, physical and emotional, is still prevalent in modern society. It ravaged the Powell family, and it isn't a secret they're not alone. This is many people's family. Keeping secrets, maintaining a facade of normalcy, of belonging, it's truly sad. What transpires in this case is haunting because the symbolism is embedded in the horrifying end. Josh trapped his sons inside a burning house they couldn't escape. And he did that because his father did it to him when he was a child. Of course, Josh burned with them, still trapped inside that house from his youth. I think a lot of people die like that, living in the past, and choosing to stay there instead of moving on. We're often told to keep the child alive inside us. Sadly, for some, the burden is too much to bear. For them, the past isn't gone. It never dies. So for now, here's hoping whatever shadow follows you from the past has fallen behind and disappeared from your sight, never to return. And all that's left is sunshine.